Spaulding, this calls for the old Billy Baru. Billy. Whoa, Billy. This is a biggie.
In your life, have you seen anything like that?
All right, we are here, episode 7 of the Conquer Golf Podcast. Just wrapped up the third week of the FedEx Cup playoffs. This is Brian Thompson alongside Kevin Noto. Got a great episode for everyone today. Obviously, recapping BMW. Had Ryder Cup roster finalized on Tuesday, or right after the tournament. Mm-hmm. And we'll review our picks and maybe chat a little bit about what's going on in the LPGA with Evian Masters. So, we've got some interesting stuff to talk about. We're also going to do a little bit and chat about some of our favorite specialty clubs, shall we say.
Yeah.
So, Kevin, I noticed that you brought with you today an ode to Keegan Bradley's caddy, Pepsi, with your Pepsi here.
What does that mean?
That's his caddy's nickname, Pepsi.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm assuming he...
I assume Pepsi's still with Keegan. I don't know. He was with Keegan for a very long time. I didn't actually pay attention that closely. But yeah, that's Pepsi.
Really?
Yeah, the story goes that he used to... I think it was Keegan on the web.com tour for a while when he first started. But he would actually...
Yeah, I think he played the Carolina tours. Yeah. And then, yeah, he grinded.
But Pepsi apparently would hide Pepsis throughout the course and drink them just uncontrollably. So I appreciate that.
That's
You brought Pepsi.
Yeah. In homage.
Yeah. Yep. Before 7:30. That's impressive.
Yeah.
He would be proud.
Yep. Good. I'm glad. He's my new role model. So.
Oh man. So, I mean, what were your thoughts on just him coming through finally? Obviously he's had some good finishes, but, it was kind of nice to see him pull through, I thought.
Yeah, I mean, he's always one of the best ball strikers on tour. Listening to the broadcasts, they were saying he might very well be the best driver on tour. But it's that putting, and he made some putts. He made a really good birdie on 17. I believe he birdied like 4 out of his final 6 holes or something like that. It was impressive. He made a couple long putts early in the round, and then he missed also a couple short ones, but steadied the ship and got it done and got a little bit of help from Justin Rose. I mean, they both bogeyed 18. They both went into 18 at 21 under and finished at 20, but it was impressive. Yeah, good for him. I mean, it's been a long road back. He's never lost his card since the anchor ban, has he?
No. Well, he also had the PGA Championship.
Is that 5-year?
Yeah, so he's had kind of a buffer, if you will.
Yeah.
But it is interesting that this year you've definitely seen more players who are, you know, used to anchor, who seem to be kind of having a bit of a resurgence. And it seems like it's, like, there's a lot of guys that are adopting, like, new sort of takes on the anchored band. You see all these guys that are sort of anchoring up to the forearm, mm-hmm. and then you've got all these like modified claws and everything, and like
just looking at this leaderboard, Justin Rose and Billy Horschel do claws, Xander and Rory are pretty normal, but Webb Simpson, so you know, 3 out of the top, I don't know, top 7 people on this leaderboard have alternate grips.
Yeah.
So I wonder when the change will be where in golf we actually see more people with non-conventional grips. Think that'll ever happen?
Yeah, I don't know. Do you...
Keegan's like, long putter too. It's anchored to form.
He's like Bryson and Webb.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, do you think, like, is that something that is going to be outlawed at some point?
Like the forearm I could see. But, I mean, I think not for a long time. I don't think the tour or the USGA can have another rule change about putting, right, when all these guys develop a new way. Just for optics reasons, right?
Right. Well, that's true.
But if politics wasn't involved like that, or optics, I would assume they'd say the only part of your body that can touch a club would be below the wrist or something, you know?
Like, yeah, I mean, obviously you'd have to make some, you know, concessions for people that, you know, amputees and of the like, yeah. But like, obviously they're not playing on the PGA Tour, at least not yet. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I don't know what, I just am very uncomfortable with this, like, anchoring in general, of any kind, whether it's to your body or to your forearm or it just, I don't know. I feel like there's a certain element of skill that is being nullified by that. Like, whether or not that skill is valuable, I don't know. Although that being said, I guess I don't know if I really believe that or not. Cause like, it's not like I'm anchoring
because it's better.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at the best putters on tour, most probably aren't anchoring. Yeah. But I understand what you're saying. It's like, have you ever played pool and you got that shot that you can't reach with both hands? So you pull out the bridge.
Yeah.
And you use the bridge and then you hit it and you're like, am I allowed to use the bridge every time? Because it's way better than my left hand trying to hold this pull cue on my right hand. But no one does, and I don't know why. But whenever I've thought of anchoring, it's similar to that. Like, similar to pulling out the bridge and pull, where you're just like, wow, this is unfair. But then again, no one does it, and I don't know why.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
It is really interesting.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of bogeying 18, Justin Rose bogeyed 18 to become number one in the world. Yeah. Bogeyed 18 twice.
Yeah, in the playoff.
That's
too.
Always so weird when you like somebody like becomes number one and they didn't win the week they became number one. I don't know.
Yeah,
I think that's kind of odd. I know why. Obviously, it's the way the world golf ranking works.
Is it your last like 30 events or something that it calculates?
It's a rolling 2-year weighted average. So like the last like 6 weeks you get full credit for, and then it like tapers off over the, you know, the two rolling 2-year period. So, I mean, obviously I wouldn't suggest that Justin Rose is not deserving of number one. I think he's been certainly probably the most consistent player of the last 2 years, which
I think that's very true.
Yeah. You know, he seems to be up there very consistently. And
him or DJ, you'd have to say, and they're probably one and two. But yeah, it's hard to argue with that. I think he has 4 worldwide wins in the last 2 years too, which not too many on the PGA. Does it? How many wins does he have this year? Do we know that at all? Because he's prolific top fiver.
Yeah.
But I don't picture him being a prolific winner.
Well, he won HSBC Champions. He won Colonial.
Okay.
He's finished runner-up the last 2 weeks. Runner-up of the Open Championship.
He has 2 wins on tour this year. And
3rd at Arnold Palmer.
Yeah.
He's definitely...
He's a machine.
He is kind of a machine.
Yeah. So, I mean, he's impressive. And quite frankly, there's no... I thought Dustin Johnson was going to run away with the number one ranking. Run away and hide in the last... But yeah, the last... I mean, he won the Canadian.
Yeah.
But like, since then and kind of a little bit before then, it's just been lackluster. So I thought he was going to cement himself as like... the clear-cut number one and win 5 times this year, and he just didn't.
Yeah.
So, we have more of this back-and-forth wishy-washy number one, which we'll probably have for a while, because...
You think so?
I do. I think, you know, Justin Rose, Dustin Johnson, I think... I mean, not DeChambeau yet, but Justin Thomas is going to win a couple times a year always. I think Rory might hit a hot streak next year or something and get back up there. I don't know.
What do you think? I think next year, I'm making bold prediction right now. Tiger Woods is going to be the number one player in the world next year.
Do you think it's more likely he becomes number one in the world or wins a major?
More likely. I think it's more likely that he'll become number one in the world.
I do too.
Yeah.
I do too.
Yeah. Not that I think it's unlikely that he would be like, but he could very well do
US one with a Pebble. Right. So keep that in mind.
Well, yeah, he's going to have to beat me, though.
That's true. Yep.
knock on wood. Man, I need to start practicing. Speaking of which, it's so funny. I had a friend of mine who's he's a very average recreational player, bogey golfer.
Mm-hmm.
He's our age, early 30s. And he asked me the other day, he's like, do you think if I just, like, if I was able to like retire early and I just focused entirely on golf, like, do you think I hired a full-time coach, do you think I could make it? I looked him straight in the mouth, I was like, no chance.
Mm-hmm.
Like, absolutely no. And it's like, there's people out there that think that, and I'm like, to me, it's a little bit insulting. Like,
you hear stories about people that picked up the game late that made it on tour. They're very few and far between, and I don't know what they have, but you can almost watch someone play once, and I hate to say this, and know if that's a possibility for him, right? Like,
yeah.
You remember Matt Betancourt?
Yeah.
He played on tour?
Yep.
I think the first golf tournament he ever played in was when he was, like, 28, 29. Really? And it was, like, NCGA.
Yeah.
Yeah. He crushed it
in NCGA when we were, like, in high school.
Yeah. So he became very good in the span of, like, a couple years, but the rumor has it his first golf tournament was like when he was older or something. Like, I don't know about 28, but I'm saying like,
yeah,
like upper 20s.
Yeah, that's
so. But the average person, you almost have to have started and have, like, when you're young, you have to have these habits and feelings and intimate knowledge of the game built over the course of 15 years. Or,
well, yeah, I mean, because, like, I was telling my buddy, I'm like, okay, yeah, you could start now, but guess what? You're competing against people that have been doing it for the last 15 or 20 years. Like, what is going to give? And guess what? They're doing the exact same thing that you're doing. So, like, yeah.
I mean, you'll gain on them. That
maybe. Like, no, I'm serious. So there's also a funny story. I forget what. Was it in one of Harvey Penick's books? But basically, I don't know if it was in one of his books or if I read it somewhere else, but somebody like went to the pro at Austin Country Club and was like, all right, I'm 48. I've got the next 2 years. I want to focus on my game and ramp up for the senior tour. And the head pro goes, oh, that's great. I got somebody else I want you to meet. He's actually outside in the driving range. His name's Tom Kite.
Yeah.
He's doing the same thing. It's like, you know, like, yeah, good luck, buddy.
Yeah, what are you thinking?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know where it comes from. Like, the thought that all it takes is practice. Like, all it takes is hours. Because I don't think that's the case. I think some people are born with not, like, special abilities, but, like, it's like a mindset. It's, I don't know. There's so much to it, and I can't explain it, and I can't quantify it, but, like, what's the difference between Zach Johnson and, you know, other guys on the Nationwide Tour or web.com?
I think it's mostly ours, to be honest.
Really?
But that's why I think that somebody who's 33, who's at a deficit of like 20,000 hours, is not going to make up ground on somebody who's...
I think it's already mostly mental.
I mean,
I think the difference between putting in 40 hours a week on golf and 60 hours a week, I don't think is that much.
I agree on that. I mean, there's like
a limit.
Quantity practice versus quality practice, and certainly you want to have quality practice, right? Like, that's, you could certainly waste a lot of time practicing if you're not, you know, going about it in some sort of strategic way. I think, to me, the biggest thing that makes people, like, not get better, I think there's two things. One, people have loss aversion, which essentially means they don't want to lose what they already have.
irrespective of how crappy they may be,
yeah,
like their familiarity with that is like something that they don't want to lose hold of. And so they're not willing to like actually do anything different.
Yeah.
I think I'm certainly guilty of that. I think you're very guilty of that. Like,
me? Yes, yeah, extremely.
Yeah. And like, and it's, I mean, it, for somebody like you and I, it's probably, it makes a little bit more sense because we can actually play at a reasonable level. Yeah. Right. Whereas like what I think is really interesting is when you get like middle handicappers that, you know, have that same mentality. I'm like, you're not good. Like, you have nothing to lose. Like, why don't you try this different way or think about it a little bit in this different way? And not that you have to have a new idea all the time. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is, like, usually there's, like, some idea or method that is very clearly a flaw in this person's game, and they're just not willing or able to make that transition from what they are familiar with to this other thing that maybe they even know is the right thing, but it's like loss of aversion and unwillingness to be uncomfortable just gets in their way. And it's hard. I think it's taken me a really long time to appreciate that. But I think that's probably the single biggest reason people don't get better. And single biggest reason people that spend a ton of time practicing don't get that much better. Now, on the other side of it, I think the one thing that makes somebody like Zach Johnson really good is that he hasn't tried to do anything different for a very long time.
And he's a master of his own way.
Totally. Right. And he's not trying to find a method. He knows his method and he just does it and does it and does it and does it. And it's like, at this point, if he tried to change, he'd be off the tour real quick, but he doesn't need to. And he's become that much more confident in his own game.
Yeah.
And accepting who he is and, you know, not as a golfer and, well, hopefully as a person too, but that wasn't really what I was going after,
but
So like if you have something that's functional, then I think so that's actually an interesting point, right? So like somebody like Zach Johnson who has like functional capabilities on the golf course, like he can hit great shots, like a lot of people like that would screw themselves up because they like,
or a hunt for
hunt for something else when they don't really need something else. They just need to master what they have, and then you have the flip side of like people that like literally don't have something functional and they're like trying to just rehearse that to the point that they actually make it functional, which is like probably I don't think that'll ever the person who like has a massive scoop at the bottom of their swing.
Yeah.
You know, like the bottom of their swing arc is like 6 inches behind the ball and they either thin it or chunk the heck out of it. And they're like, oh, how come I keep doing that? It's like, because your swing sucks.
Yeah.
Like,
and they refuse to change because when they try to change, they play worse for a week. And it's like, of course you play worse for a week.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yep. That's a...
And then and then the next thing you know, they're on Golf Channel and they're, seeing a bunch of infomercials for the, what do they call that? Square faced wedge?
The chipper?
The chipper? Well, no, it's,
this,
what's the one that, isn't it Andy North is the one that, it is a chipper, but I don't think that's what they call it.
No. It's called the
square wedge, square something. I don't know. That's one of them.
That's definitely one of them. One of the hot ones right now. So, funny story about a chipper.
Yeah.
When I was a senior in high school, our team, for some reason, we thought it was cool to have a chipper in your bag. So, I actually played a couple tournaments where I had a chipper in my bag, but I took out the 7-iron because when you full swing a chipper, it was the perfect 7-iron. And I hit these high, towering draws. But, I don't know. Maybe the square... This new square one is a better like 7 hybrid than it is actually functional.
We might have to test that. man.
Well, we got that. We got the T-less driver, which irks Brian.
Oh my. I'm sorry. I don't know Noda Begay from Adam, but I cannot believe that I want to know how much money they pay him to do you see the people on that commercial that they have swinging that as if they're going to be able to hit a fairway metal off the ground and they hit it like a driver? Give me a break. A 3-wood off the ground has got to be the hardest club you could possibly hit. And yet...
Well, that's... That's the thing. So I looked it up. They're $199. You can only pre-order them right now.
$199, and they probably upsell you. You get on some mailing list, and they're going to upsell you on golf lessons. I'm sure
there's hybrids coming. Like, there's a T-less 3-wood, which T-less or 3-woods are always meant to be T-less.
I've got it. I'm going to invent the T-less sand wedge. You don't need a T to hit your sand wedge.
Oh, actually, they're worse.
Come on. You mean they're worse?
$297.
Oh, yeah, because well, you can get it with
the... if you want to upgrade the shaft to ultimate performance, it's $347.
That is so criminal.
You have these... Yeah, you have these clubs. You have this whole business of clubs you'll never see in a Golf Mart, of clubs you'll never see in a Dick's Sporting Goods, and they all must pay a decent amount of money to have kind of has-been tour pros, right?
Yeah.
Rep these clubs, and they pay for a ton of spots, a ton of airtime on Golf Channel as well. Not to mention all the other ads they do. I'm sure they run them in all the golf magazines and social media. This must be a big business.
There has to be something there. I just... It's such a... Well, okay, so this... Yeah, this gets me to thinking about like just the golf equipment business in general, which... I think has become a huge. It's ultimately just a marketing thing,
yeah.
Right? Like it's very like. I mean, I play TaylorMade equipment. I'm very happy with my TaylorMade equipment. They make great stuff. I used to play Titleist stuff. Titleist still makes great equipment. Mm-hmm. Callaway makes great equipment.
Like, yeah,
all the companies make really good equipment, and you know, certainly some people have affinity for some equipment more than others, but like ultimately it's about the marketing. Like I think yeah. that's what this T-less driver speaks of. It's like it's all marketing. Like
yeah.
I don't know, and it just really irks me that like somehow they're selling this idea that like if you can't hit your driver off a tee, you're going to be able to hit this driver that's got like 2 extra degrees of loft off the ground,
yeah.
Like that. And they even got Noda Begay saying, "Oh yeah, you can even hit it out of a divot." I'm like, come on, nobody's hitting this out of a divot. Who's like buying this? Like,
I know, it's pretty bad, huh?
That's really bad.
Right here, it's impossible to chunk.
Come on.
Dude, right here.
They've never seen me
free
play
video
golf.
Will show you at Eversley launch soaring monster drives right off the deck, and it's impossible to chunk. But I don't know.
Impossible, I mean, to chunk. So I wonder what happens when the bottom of your swing arc runs into the ground before the ball.
Yeah, and your club bounces over the ball. It happens on half the swings, I bet, with the people that order these. But it's wild. But like to your point, so essentially selling golf clubs now is an arms race to advertising, right? It's like,
yeah.
And it's started to be a change in golf balls. You see golf balls called Snell and Vice.
Yep.
And there's this whole other sector of golf balls launching that have pretty much the same technology of all the leading balls, but they don't pay the millions and millions and millions of dollars that big brands do for sponsoring tour players, and it allows them to charge 50%, 40% less per dozen. So they don't pay, you know, Adam Scott an extra $500,000 on a win when he's using a Titleist ball. And,
yep.
And, you know, however much money they spend 1% of that.
It's an interesting arbitrage.
Yeah, I wish I would have thought of it. But essentially, I think it all started at a company called Snell. He was one of the main, I don't know, let's just call it, golf ball scientists for, I believe, TaylorMade, and he branched off and started his own company. But
trader,
it might be it might be coming with golf clubs sooner than we think too. I know it happened with shafts already.
Okay, so that leads me to something. Question: shafts. Do you think that is, there's a huge market for like aftermarket shafts, and that's a, you know, there's a lot of people that would sort of just say, yeah, the shaft is the most important piece of equipment for the club. Do you agree or disagree?
I mean, to an extent, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you think that they'd
rather have an average shaft or an average head and a good shaft than the opposite, right?
Okay.
An
average shaft, I guess that's
a good head. But if you have like a really old club or something with a good shaft, it might not be as effective as a brand new head.
Yeah. Yeah, that's probably true. Like, yeah, if you put in your like original Big Bertha Warbird 5-wood with some graphite design
with a really 7X good shaft
or something
it might not be
quite as good,
but once you have something that's pretty modern and made in the last 5 years, I'm sure I'd rather have a good shaft in any club like that.
I think that's what I'm getting at, right? Is that like the USGA and the RNA, they have rules around like how good the equipment can be, right? Mm-hmm. And what you've seen in the last, I would say, 3 to 5 years is that the equipment has gone from, you know, kind of these technological enhancements to make the clubs hotter and more forgiving and all this stuff. And basically they've just like the whole shift has been towards customizing things that are, you know, are tweaked specifically to your game, which I think makes sense.
Yeah.
And you're even seeing people customize things like Cobra's got the MyFly when you can have a different color driver and stuff. And like, honestly, like that's really the game, I think, in the equipment space now, is that, you know, they just have to make everything perfectly, you know, totally customizable,
mm-hmm.
so that it feels more like yours and it was made just for you. Like,
yeah.
But on the, you know, just if you take just a one club and compare it to another and they're the same specs, like the difference is pretty negligible, I would say. I also get a kick out of it. Like, I don't know if you've seen any friends that have posted like their new Titleist driver, and they hold up the sign that says, "I added 5 miles an hour of ball speed and like 15, you know, yards to my tee shot." And I'm like, okay, if you did that, one of two things happened. Either A, you weren't warmed up when you started with your own driver, which is a real thing. When I warm up, I add 5 miles an hour club head speed from the time that I'm like just starting to the time that I'm like fully warmed up and ready. Like, that's why these players get to the range an hour ahead of time,
mm-hmm.
When they go to play.
Yeah.
And then secondly, the other thing is your other driver probably just wasn't fit properly for you.
Yeah.
So it's like, it's not like this, you're just going to change out this club and, you know, it's going to be a lifesaver. Oh, and then you got the Warrior clubs.
I looked up Warrior clubs, gosh. Too. It's just, the Warriors are the most famous infomercial club to me, because it's like, they've been around forever. I think you buy one, you get a wedge for free for only shipping and handling. But
these
guys
must be marketing geniuses.
I've actually seen players at ranges with full sets of Warrior clubs, too. So, they exist. And they exist in a very big fashion. So, it's unbelievable. The infomercial golf club market is bigger than we could ever imagine, I believe. Bigger than we could ever imagine.
It's very interesting. All right, that was a massive tangent, and we've spent a lot of time, although I think that was pretty interesting.
Yeah. last week's results?
Yeah, let's go through the picks from last week and see how we fared.
Brian picked Rory to win. He took minus 18, took a solo fifth. So he looked good for a long time. He just could not make putts the Monday, but good week for him.
Yep.
Anytime there's a soft golf course, I like Rory.
Yeah.
So.
Yep.
Ted Potter, he picked to place last. He took dead middle of the field, so T35 at -8.
He
so
was
not too
way
bad.
Up there though. At first, he was.
Yeah, he had a horrible final round, but which saved Brian. But
did.
I picked Francesco Molinari to win, T8 at -16. This golf course must have been long for him. So I was watching the Monday final round, and I kid you not, Rory had 200 and like 18 yards into, I don't know what hole it was, and he was hitting a wood. And they were all hitting woods from like 252 and coming up short on par fives, and they might have been uphill, but like that never happens.
Yeah, never
happens. You'll more often see people hit 4 irons from 250 than 3 woods, right?
Yeah.
And they couldn't even come up. They couldn't even get to the hole. It was wild. So that must have been a long course for Francesco. And then I picked Ches Reavie to finish last. He took T38 at -7, so bottom half of the field, but still not very good.
All right.
Cool. Well, we're not going to make our picks for the Tour Championship yet. You're going to have to tune in next week. One thing we didn't talk about before we wrap up, Tony Finau ended up getting selected as the fourth and final captain's pick for the U.S. squad. I think you and I were both in agreement that was more or less a foregone conclusion.
I mean, unless Xander won, which he placed in the top five this week, so kudos, he made one last push, but that's Tony Finau's, because, again, Tony Finau finished around top 10 somewhere. So
yeah, I mean, Tony he was extremely consistent all year. I mean, how many, he had like 11 top 10s or something? It was something outrageous.
Especially as of late, right?
Yeah, and 11 top 10s.
He took multiple, and in majors he played good too.
He did. He had like his three best finishes in majors all this year.
Yeah, so he's ready.
Yeah, definitely ready. So congrats to him. I think it'll be fun to check that out. We'll definitely talk more about that in the weeks to come. But yeah, congrats to Tony on getting selected to the team. Well deserved.
Justin Rose, number one in the world.
Yep.
Pretty good. So yeah, exciting week.
Yeah, shaping up to be a good Tour Championship, good FedEx Cup finale here, and obviously Ryder Cup right on the heels of that. So should be good. That's all for this week. Appreciate everybody listening, and enjoy every shot.
Yep. See ya.
I'm just sitting here in front of you guys. I'm talking. Just hanging out here.